very great pleasure to be here, and many thanks for the invitation to speak here. I'd like to take this opportunity also of apologising to the speakers this morning. I didn't intend to get here, but British Rail kind of got in the way. I apologise again. Here I'm really describing work in progress. Just some results which were obtained as late as last week. So we haven't had any time really to look at convergence and complexity, but there are some results which indicate how things are going. So strategies for the evaluation of boundary integrals arising at 3D partition unity the Helmholtz problems. The last speaker has done a lot of my introductory work for me, so I'll zip through the initial slides which show the problem we're trying to solve, and then spend more time hopefully on the integrals themselves. Just like to point out this is joint work with my researcher McConnor in Durham, also strongly influenced by Dan Heinrichs. A bit of background, I think everyone here is aware of that. So limitation of shortwave scattering to the classical rules of thumb, 10 modes per wavelength, 10 degrees of freedom per wavelength. And without trying to dwell on these other methods that are out there, I recognise that partition unity method in finite element and boundary element is just one approach to overcome this limitation. Many other types of methods available for this, but the partition unity, going back to Melik and Babushka, is just a general class of methods in which we build in some a priori knowledge of the solution space to enrich our approximation space. With applying that to wave problems, that can be done with plane waves, can be done with Bessel functions. Most people do this with plane waves. So it goes back to Melik and Babushka. A bunch of people have attempted this in finite elements. I'm focusing today on the boundary integral approach, but just to mention these papers here. But they all use a plane wave basis, this sort, where they express the potential field you're looking to seek as a linear combination of plane waves traveling in different directions. Other authors have applied this using boundary elements, boundary integrals. Once again, we see here, well, they fall into two categories. Some of the researchers use a multiple plane wave basis, which is the expression on the top, and others use just, I'm too far away, others use just the incident wave as the enrichment function. We should be dealing with the top one, which is the multiple plane wave basis, so that should be the integration scheme. It won't make any difference which one we use, it will apply to both. So really the same equations, classical Helmholtz equation in three dimensions this time, with an object, I've noted in a circle, can be any convex or non-convex scatterer, general scatterer, or multiple scatterers, a boundary gamma, and it's impinged by an incident wave, an incident plane wave, and we have a general form of boundary condition. And once again, the boundary condition I'm not going to dwell on here. It's just I'm looking at the boundary integrals themselves rather than the type of problem we're solving. So a classical boundary integral equation at the top, so the plane wave basis hasn't been introduced there. In 2D, of course, the Green's function is a Hankel function, I over 4 H naught KR. R has its usual boundary element meaning. And 3D, the expressions are the simpler ECI KR over 4 pi R. So, in this multiple plane wave basis, we're expanding the potential U that we seek in an expansion which contains the normal polynomial shape functions. So we have J of those. The J nodes on the element, we have M plane waves that we're expanding this solution in, and so we have a JM of these plane waves on the element that we're dealing with, and each one has an amplitude. The amplitude is A, capital A, now become the unknowns in the problem, and the plane waves become built into, it can be thought of being built into the shape functions. Almost all the research you see in this, the plane waves are uniformly distributed around the unit circle. That's of course trivial in 2D in this way. In 3D, where I like to look at it is, let's see if I can do it here. We have a little algorithm for arbitrary number of plane waves, arbitrary m. Let's go for something like just a random number, 152. And here, what I'm going to do is look at a little simulation here. We're treating these plane wave directions around the unit sphere as charged particles floating on the surface of the sphere. We have 152 of them. There's the Coulombic interactions between each particle, 1 over r squared is the force. And all we're doing is a little time stepping scheme so that these 152, in this case, particles settle into a static equilibrium. The different colors, blobs, are the particles on the front of the sphere and on the back of the sphere. There's a lot of algorithms out there for doing that. Let's just try something a bit different. Let's try 213, just to have some fun. This is greatly slowed down, by the way. I put a little sort of sleep command in there, just to so you can see the animations and the way it's going. So this is quite a nice scheme for generating a pseudo uniform distribution on the 3D surface for an arbitrary n. Let's kill that. Okay, so having designed our directions then, we proceed. Of course, now we've got each node has multiple degrees of freedom, those the A's. So we have m degrees of freedom per node. And so if we're using a direct collocation method, we need more collocation points than there are nodes, and we do that just by distributing the collocation points over the element. And again, simple in two dimensions like this, is the boundary element, 2D quadratic element, the red ones are the nodes and the yellow ones are the collocation points. And similarly in 3D we can scatter collocation points over the surface of the element. So just very quickly, again, I don't want to dwell on the method itself, I'd rather move forward to the integrals that we're looking to solve, to evaluate. Here we have some have scatter from a circle in a cylindrical scatter, a 2D problem. Ka is 20 pi. And I beg your pardon, I haven't defined my terms here. This is something I'll be telling someone off for when I get back in a PhD examination. Tor is number of degrees of freedom per wavelength. So I've got 2.5 here. So this is the thing which you might like to compare with the 8 or 10 rule of thumb from classical methods. And here this is solved using just four elements, each going around 90 degrees of the surface. The quadratic, so there's 8 nodes. And we use m equals 20, 20 plane waves per node. And these are the results where, committing cardinal sins here. I haven't got my axes labeled. The horizontal axis is just the perimeter of the scatterer, and the vertical axis, the real part of the potential. And as you can see, we have four elements over the surface there, so each one is spanning many, many wavelengths. The imaginary part looks the same. There's the magnitude of the potential for that simple problem. You see it's peaking out the physical optics solution 2 on the illuminated surface. Just having a look at the error analysis of the algorithm, we have here, we're plotting a relative error here, epsilon, on the log scale, of course, against Ka. And we have a number of lines on this graph, so very quickly, this is the classical quadratic polynomial basis, conventional boundary elements, direct collocation. And all of these are various flavors of the partition unity, in which n is the number of elements, m is the number of plane waves per node. Maybe it's the number of nodes, I can't remember, but it doesn't matter. Each one of these sets of data involves models of the same number of degrees of freedom. So m times m is the same in each case. It's a measure of degrees of freedom. And what we find is clearly it's outperforming the classical method by some margin. In fact, way down here, we're finding at the low frequencies, which is actually not where this technique is aimed, but the low frequencies we have 2, 4, 6, 7, or 8 orders of magnitude reduction in error, which is very exciting. Or you could choose to look at it with an engineering accuracy. If you like, as an engineer, it's important to me. Engineering accuracy of 1% gives you something like a 3-to-1 improvement in frequency range of the salt. It turns out, actually, that the better of these flavors of PUM are the ones where you have just one or two elements, one element going all the way around, and lots of plane waves per node, you get better behavior. Okay, so moving forward to 3D. There's no analytical solution for this shape, of course, so we're just showing some converged results here. I only put it in because it's a nice picture, really. There's no real intellectual value in it. Okay, so moving on. We're all used to, in computational mechanics, having the solver being the phase that dominates, but now we've reduced the number of degrees of freedom quite considerably, but that's been done at the cost of making our integrals highly oscillatory, the boundary integrals that we have to integrate. And so the problems we've run so far has been greatly dominated by the integration. Now, as you increase k, ultimately the solver will start to dominate again, I believe. We haven't got that far yet, nowhere near it. But for now, the thing that we're looking to do is improve the integration speed. And this is a form of the boundary integrals that we're addressing. So we have two of them. We thought of single and double layer tensions, if you like. But they're a product of the Green's function times the polynomial shape function times the oscillatory plane wave. So there's two components to the oscillation. One is the Green's function, which goes with r, distance away from the collocation point. And one varies, this is the oscillatory direction for the plane wave. It's very good, it's a djm. D is the unit vector for the plane wave direction. So we're building into the basis for this particular integral. And we've called that lowercase g sub jm. So I'll be referring to that quite a lot as we go through the rest of the talk. Now, in the early papers that we wrote on this, Carré de Bain et al., we were using really a brute force approach. So Gauss Legendre integration, 30 Gauss points per wavelength, which gave us the accuracy that we needed. And we were doing that with a triangular quadrature scheme from Linus and Jespersen from quite a long time ago. Move on. So those are the integrals that we're looking for. Just to give you some visual impact for what these integrals look like. So here I've drawn two surfaces. One is the octant of a spherical surface, and one is a triangle which is embedded within the middle of the sphere there. And what I'm doing is considering the red blob as kind of on the back surface. That's the collocation point. I'm looking at what happens when we sweep the plane wave direction around the equatorial direction. And those are the two surfaces that we could look at. You see what happens when I sweep that around. We get an rather interesting sort of bullseye effect that crosses the surface of the element. If we keep the plane wave direction constant, this time move the collocation point around equatorially, what happens? We get a similar sort of behavior, but still we have a very highly oscillatory integral. Finally, we'll just keep the collocation point and the plane wave the same, just in arbitrary places and arbitrary directions, and vary the wave number. In this case, the form seems the same, but the frequency increases, of course. So these are the sort of integrals that we're trying to evaluate over the surfaces. So moving forward to the strategy that we've decided to look at these integrals with. So it involves subdivision of the element into patches, so 3- and 4-sided quadratic patches that we're using. Each patch is gamma q, so q, the new subscript I'm introducing is the subdivision number in the element. And just to remind you, there's the form of the integrals again, the boundary integrals again. And those patch edges, the subdivision is formed along the oscillatory direction, the oscillatory coordinate. And in fact, well, it's an approximation to the oscillatory coordinate. Here's our r plus d dot x. It's the r is the again the oscillatory direction for the Green's function. The d dot x is the oscillatory direction for the plane wave. They're built into the same exponential term. R plus d dot x is our g. It's almost the oscillatory direction. I mean, it does get, you have other terms thrown in here, so it's only an approximation to it. But we use that because it's very, very fast. We can develop contours of this variable, which is non-oscillatory. It's just the direction along which something else is oscillating. This itself is non-oscillatory. And we can develop contours of that very rapidly.
By quadratic patches, you just mean sort of curvilinear rectangles?
Yeah, I'm just going to... Good point. Here's an example which will answer your question. So here's a fairly simple case, just a flat rectangular element in three-dimensional space. So it's going to x equals 1, y equals 1, z equals 2. So that's the size of the element. I'm going to draw the function for the integrand for k equals 40, so comparatively low mid-range frequency. And we have these collocation points and plane wave directions. And so the first thing that we would do then is to draw these contours of g, j, m dot of x. So this is the non-oscillatory function. And so these blue lines are iso contours of a constant g. When we've developed those, we can then fire a set of orthogonal vectors and have this orthogonal set. We call them the major and the minor lines, but you can see what's going on. So that we would develop the blue ones first, and then from those the red ones. So now we have this curvilinear set, which is based on the wave crests. And you can see that the blue ones will be approximately along the wave crest of the integrands to integrate. From that we build this quadratic subdivision. There's some blobs here you see, which look rather like nodes. They're not. They're just used to define these quadratic surfaces geometrically. There's no degrees of freedom associated with those. And you can see there's some bits around the edges, such as down here, where we're having to we're doing some minor changes to those to make things better for ourselves later on. I'll go into that in a moment. Okay, for each of these biquadratic subdivisions, then we'll map that to a psi eta space. So that's -1 to +1 in both directions in a classical way. There's subscripts and superscripts. So the JM relates to the integral that we're looking to evaluate. The Q, which I put as a superscript, it refers to the subdivision number within the patch. Sum over. And the important thing is that the integral is approximately non-oscillatory in the psi JMQ direction. And the response to that is to, of course, use low-order integration in that direction. But we still need the high-order integration in the other direction, but we're saving quite markedly there. So we still use the 30 points per wavelength that was found from previous work, just to be consistent with previous work, in the eta direction, the local eta direction. But we found that using just 8 gauss of psi along the psi direction is sufficient. Not per wavelength, 8 across the whole thing. This is the main problem with this. I'm going to show you some results in a moment, but the main problem is that there are some bits around the edge that are not applicable to this technique. It does rely on the fact that the top and or bottom of the subdivision is along the wave, is lying along the wave crest, if you like. And there's some of these, particularly for example the ones at the top, you can see that although the bottom of it lies on one of the contours of G, the top of the surface does not, and so we can't find the top. And similarly, around the corner here, around the bottom. And for those who go back to the old-fashioned way, high order gases are in both directions. Okay, so moving forward a little bit then, we can take each of these high order lines, which are approximately vertical, they're in the eta direction, and we can apply Heibrechts and van der Waals' numerical steepest descent over those, and that'll save us something. And so we can evaluate the integral over the red lines individually, and then combine them together with Gauss-Legendre weights to recover the integral over the surface of that subdivision. And so, what have we got here? So we've got the integral over the two local coordinates of some slowly varying function f. It's the shape function number 1 over r and so on. And here we have the oscillatory bit, e to the ikg of x of the new coordinates. And we're rewriting that as the summation of Gauss-Legendre descent. So here's the Gauss-Legendre weight of alpha order Gauss-Legendre in the psi direction. Here's the psi l and the psi l here. But in the other direction, we're retaining the statement of the integral. And that's the part, this integral, that we will take in the numerical steepest descent. I never know as an engineer, when I come to places like this, how much detail to go into, how much, maybe I'm sort of teaching you second year mathematical undergraduate theory, I don't know. But essentially what we're doing is taking the minus one and plus one, instead of evaluating that along the real axis of eta, we're transforming the contour into a complex plane, so we'll develop a complex plane H, and still go from minus one to plus one, but to go along a different path, and the path is that path which satisfies this expression. So g of x is g of h effectively is g of eta plus ip, and p is now the variable of integration. So typically those are the sort of paths that we find. We're going from minus one to plus one. Those are the two points at the top. In this case, the path starts at minus one, which I've labelled with A at the top, comes down to, it goes out to this P equals infinity, and across, and then back up again, a similar looking path to plus one, zero in the complex plane. And when you substitute that G of X equals G of H plus IP, or is it the other way around, into the integral, what happens is that you get a constant term which can come out of the integral, which happens to be e to the ikg at the start or end of the path, and then an infinite integral from p from 0 to infinity of some function in which the exponential now contains minus kp. It's non-oscillatory, and so we can evaluate that quickly. Strictly, there's also a path which closes this, gives you a closed contour between the end here and the end here. And that occurs at p equals infinity, and that exponential just vanishes. And so we can do that there. So for each path, then, we've reduced it to linear summation here. This is the Gauss-Legendre weights to take care of the psi direction. And this is the integral that's left with the steepest descent. For the eta direction, transformed into the complex space with this variable p. And this can be evaluated very efficiently using Gauss-Laguerre quadrature on that path, and we found that the 8 points, 8th-order quadrature over each path is sufficient. So very, very efficient. Since we only need to establish evaluate the functions at these Gauss points, Gauss-Laguerre points, we can define the path completely in terms of those points. We're not interested in the path at any point in between those. This is just diagrammatic only. Actually, in practice, all of these 8 points would fall probably before you reach two of them at the top. in the cases that we've tried. So we're very much compressed towards the real axis. So
we find that quite right. You'll still get the right answer, won't you? If the path isn't exactly correct, you'll still get exactly.
You'll still get the right answer, but it will become oscillatory.
Not much, because if you're going down into a valley, that's stable.
Well, it's true. Yeah. It depends how close your path is.
Yeah.
There are some issues that we need to grapple with here, particularly with where g prime, or the derivative of g becomes small. This appears actually in here. It's hidden. It's in this Jacobian term. So the Jacobian is I over the derivative of g. And in some cases, that can become small. And if that's true, where it falls below some threshold, which I'm being very, very vague about here, I think this is largely because it's different in the examples we've tried in 3D to what we've done in 2D, and it's frequency dependent as well. And I think this is one of the issues we're really trying to get a handle on at the moment. But for cases which fall below some threshold, we make a transformation of this form, p equals y to the power u. And so moving that transformation from forward, you still get the g prime in the denominator, of course, but you get extra terms up here because y will be going to zero as well. And the idea is to make that go to zero faster than the g prime. That is less efficient. It works out that actually these are some numerical experiments, so there's nothing theoretically going on here. We just tried lots of different cases, and we find that u equals 4, so we're raising the y to the power 4, and evaluating over a truncated interval with Gauss-Lejeune quadrature. But we do need 64 Gauss points, so it's markedly more Gauss points than required in this transformed version. So just to finish up with some errors and efficiency statements here. So here's an example for that same flat element, and these are the top three rows of the number of Gauss points that are required. There's a rather frightening number of Gauss points here, but please don't be swayed by this. This is just a reference case which we're producing 256 Gauss points in each direction. And this is just to give us a reference case which we're considering has zero error, which is but it does allow us to relate the errors. So we have the old-fashioned wave, 30 Gauss points per wavelength in each direction, 14.5 million. This is our selective scheme without the steepest descent, so this is 30 Gauss points in the oscillatory direction, and just 8, not per wavelength, but across the entire subdivision in the non-oscillatory direction. And we're reducing quite markedly, so from 14.5 million to 1.2 million. And when you introduce steepest descent, it comes down slightly. But the main thing is that I'm going to come to it, it's dominated by the next two rows. So the full NGP and the cell NGP, this one is the bit of that this is the number of Gauss points that we need for all those shaded bits around the edges, around the periphery of the element. And the selective one, well, that's the number of Gauss points we need in the vast majority of the element, which was not shaded. And you see the whole thing is very much dominated by the bits around the periphery.
What is the scatterer here? What is the body?
Arbitrary. This is just one element we're looking at. It's just a rectangular element.
So this is for the full acoustic integral, or?
On just one element. This is just one element for one collocation point for one plane wave direction. So this has to be repeated many, many times throughout.
That is for the combined field integral, or?
This is just for a collocation point. Happily, the CPU time for setting up all the subdivisions, drawing the contours, and doing the quadratic subdivisions is almost negligible in comparison with the Gauss point evaluations. And so we can say that it's almost exactly proportional to the total number of Gauss points. The selective scheme within the steepest descent, that has introduced some complex arithmetic, so it's not exactly proportional, but it does give you a pretty good guide. Doubling the frequency k, we can see that we're getting this is going with k squared, this is going with k, and this is going with approximately order 1, but it's going to take a lot more tests to establish exactly what the order is. And Well, here's a triangular element case. So you can see the same sort of behavior is happening with similar effects on the number of Gauss points that you need. So although it's still going up with k squared because of these bits around the edge, the coefficient in front of the k squared has come down quite a lot. And that's useful. But I think where we would like to go with this is to try and deal with those shaded bits around the edges which are dominating the whole duration. It may be that something, I mean, it would lead to either something like Oscar's overlapping patches, maybe integrating further than the edge of the element, that could help. It might even lead to something like a meshless method, which could be quite attractive in this approach. But it's definitely work in progress. And so just to finish up then, just a few bullet points just to say at the top, we've incorporated the plane wave basis in which the solution, the approximation space. But it does give us these oscillatory integrals that we have to deal with. Really, the scheme is based on a simple idea that you can draw these subdivisions in the oscillatory direction of the integrand, then you can get away with low-order integration in the non-oscillatory direction. If you include the numerical steepest descent of Weinberg and von der Weller, that can enhance the efficiency, but the whole thing is dominated by the bits around the edges. I think that's all I want to say, so thanks very much for your attention.